So the last thing that I made with my butcher box shipment was aloo chicken, and it turned out really well. One of my favorite things is to get the shipment and then open up the New York Times cooking app and see what I want to create over the next few weeks. It helps my creative cooking chops, and both my wife and I really enjoy it. ButcherBox offers a variety of high-quality cuts at an amazing price, plus they have exclusive member deals, and they also have their own recipes, although I am preferential to the New York Times app, but that's just me. And you can sign up today at butcherbox.com/conspirituality and get their special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free-for-a-year offer plus an additional $20 off. So for that year, you can choose salmon, chicken breast, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/conspirituality and use code conspirituality to choose your free for a year offer, plus get $20 off your first order.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to Conspirituality, where we investigate the intersection of conspiracy theories and spiritual influence to uncover cults, pseudoscience, and authoritarian extremism. I'm Julian Walker, and I'm joined today by Nagin Shirigahi, who is an Iranian activist, entrepreneur, and former BBC World Service news reporter and presenter. She campaigns for women's rights and has spoken twice at the United Nations Human Rights Council. Nagin, thank you so much for being here with me.
Oh, thank you for having me, Julian.
I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly.
Yes.
Good.
It's correct.
Good. So Iran is in the news a lot lately because of current events in the Middle East and their proxy involvement with Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Houthis. But in the year or so prior to the October 7th attacks, a very different story was dominating any coverage of the Islamic Republic. So let's start with the slogan, woman, life, freedom. I understand it emerged first in the early 2000s as part of the Kurdish Women's Freedom Movement, which is situated in the broader context of the Kurdish struggle against oppression through Iran, Iraq, Turkey, and Syria. And I found out recently it's also been used by all-female militia groups in the war against ISIS, which is impressive. But more recently, the slogan has been associated since September of 2022 with the tragic death of a young woman named Mahsa Amini. And that rallying cry, woman, life, freedom, has now become much more widespread in Iran and globally. So tell us about that.
It's a really interesting slogan, as you mentioned. I'm going to share a personal story about this because I left BBC around like 3 years, 4 years before, you know, Mahsa Amini's death. During that time, a lot of stuff happened in Iran. There were protests. It wasn't a quiet country. When Women Life Freedom came, I resonated with it because it involved all of those values that I was fighting for it for my whole life. And I think the important thing is the values. When Abdullah Öcalan, the Kurdish leader, created this and thinker created this slogan and then the philosophy and theory around it, it was at the heart of it was women's rights, you know, the famous sentence. If you don't, we don't observe women's rights, the human rights wouldn't be achievable. And it, the same goes with environmental issues, because Iran has a lot of environmental issues as well, and then the fight around liberty. I think the slogan itself, it talks about the values that are really current and really close to a lot of people around the world globally, because we are all, wherever we are in the corners of the world, we are facing the rise of misogyny and extremism. It was understandable that really quickly, not only Iran adopted this slogan from the Kurdish region, which Jina Mahsa Amini was from, also other women around the world that started talking about it. We've seen Afghan, amazing Afghan women, brave women inside Afghanistan dancing in support of women like freedom under Taliban. We've seen women in Syria doing the same, or a lot of Arab countries, China, even Latin America. So I think it goes down to the values that this slogan is representing.
Yeah, and just for any listeners who may be unaware, can you give us just the couple sentence summary of what happened to her?
So Jina, or Mahsa Amini, was a Kurdish 21-year-old Kurdish Iranian girl who was living in the Kurdish provinces, traveling to Tehran with her family, and the police, as they call it, as was nicknamed, morality police, but it's much more brutal than that, arrested her. And there were cases of brutality within that police for years. But her death, for a lot of different reasons and complications, became a momentum. There are video footages of her entering the center, detention center, and just collapsing. So the understanding that we have, because we can't trust the narrative that's coming from the Iranian government, they don't share the data, but from the pieces around, it's almost obvious now that she was beaten in the van, the car that arrested her, right there in the streets, and she had a concussion. They took her to the center, and they didn't even pay attention to she's feeling bad, and she collapsed there and just died right there. It took the Iranian government three days to kind of admit that she's not in a coma, she's dead. And then that sparked, from the moment of the beginning of it, sparked a lot of protests across the country and people chanting. And it kind of moved the Iranian society from thinking about reform, or kind of like, you know, finding a way to work within this authoritarian framework, to say enough is enough. We don't want this. It's really alive in the country. Mm-hmm. People are waiting for the future to come that is different from having Islamic Republic as a government in the country.
Yeah, and she was 22 years old, tragically, and her crime was not wearing the proper headscarf, essentially, right?
It's really complicated, because she was wearing the headscarf, even within their like framework. And it shows how, like, we always say, as a woman, our life doesn't matter in that country. Her life didn't matter. Her well-being didn't matter. She wasn't even, you know, according to some of the daughters and, you know, relatives of the people in power are wearing much more revealing clothing, and they never get into trouble. But then she's wearing really simple stuff that are, even according to their code, has no problem. And then still, she's under attack.
So the ensuing uprising led to severe crackdowns by the government. I've read that there have been mass arrests. There have been an increase in executions. I've also seen stories about expanded public surveillance using both digital technology, which must be really scary, as well as increased policing activities and, you know, just people on the streets watching, especially women's every move. What do you know about these measures? And are they effectively shutting down the protest and the women's disobedience? Like, what's going on there?
It definitely is rising the price for disobedience. So right now, if you're a woman walking down the street, you're in a car, or like not wearing the mandatory hijab, which is the way of protest that women are showing every day, their car can get confiscated. There's a big penalty for it. The public services are denied for them. So if you go to a bank, they don't even banks are private. They have this rule that they shouldn't give you service. Women get attacked by semi-militia groups. We call them BCG. Now they're like part of the Iran's revolution and called the structure. So these kind of guys or women are walking down the streets and seeing you not wearing a hijab, and they can beat you right on the spot. They can arrest you. And a lot of people, there are horrifying cases of rape, torture, shooting to the eyes, and the genitals. So they kind of use every technique and tactics to scare people and send them home. To a certain level, they were successful. But there is a there are a lot of other different reasons behind it. So we can't say, like, yeah, they went home because it was really brutal. People were ready to pay remember their lives. But there were other players, you know, in the game, and that kind of pushed people back to the houses. But women, every single day, you hear stories of women resisting. They're, like I was talking to someone in Iran that she was explaining, if I go to a, if I get into a taxi and I'm not wearing a hijab, they're going to confiscate the car of the taxi driver. So my way of doing it, protesting without creating the cost for other people, is I wear it inside the taxi. I wear it in the places that has something to do with other people. But wherever it's my, I'm the only one who's paying the price. I'm going to continue my protest. And I think Kudus is amazing, brilliant, brave women who are happy to kind of take this movement further down, because they're, you know, if you grew up in a society that's taking away all of your rights, there's a tipping point, right? Like, you cannot continue living like that. And you know there's no future for your future children or, you know, the people to come. So, and that's why when you look at the amazing materials and content that are left over from some of the people who died on the street, 16 years old, 20 years old, 18 years old, mm-hmm. having YouTube channels and talking about their lives, it's all about that. As young as that, you know, these young girls were thinking about their future, and not only themselves, the future of a nation. And they were saying, enough is enough, and I'm going to pay the price. And unfortunately, a lot of people paid a really high price for it.
Yeah, I've seen the figure of 500 people having died associated with the protests and the police state crackdowns, essentially, on that. Also men standing in solidarity with women, that significant number of those 500 dead were men. And then I saw that in October, just recently of last year, as you were saying, a 16-year-old girl, Armita Garavand, if I'm saying that correctly, died whilst in a coma after being assaulted on the Tehran metro by the morality police, so-called, in a similar kind of confrontation. And then that same month, human rights activist Narges Mohammadi was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize while serving prison time for criticizing the government. So yeah, I get that picture from you, that there is a sense of enough is enough, and we're making a stand for future generations.
Yeah, and then it's not just only death, execution, which are horrifying and a really big price. But the system is making sure that, that even if someone is posted something and got into trouble for it and went into prison, then their card, the bank card is confiscated. You know, the financial burden after any arrest is really high. And so they're using different tools and techniques to kind of calming that, damping this fire for the moment. But the amount of resistance I see in people, I don't think it's sustainable. I think really soon we're going to hear another massive round of protests happening in Iran.
Okay, so these are all fairly recent events, but I know that you grew up in Iran. You left in your early 20s to pursue journalism. You're also an activist. As I said, you've spoken twice at the UN. And you were born just a couple of years after the revolution that created the Islamic Republic of Iran and installed the first of only two supreme leaders in the last 45 years, one of them for over 30 years, I believe. I know that woman life freedom has been described as one of the biggest challenges to the regime in all of that time, but it's not the first example of women being oppressed in Iran or of protests against that. So I'm just curious, whatever you want to share about that history and your own experience, and also why you think that women are such a target of these authoritarian religious laws.
Yes, you're completely right. Like, less than a month after the victory of Islamic Republic, you know, inside Iran, there was 8th of March protests, a massive protest against the mandatory hijab, because Khomeini, the first supreme leader, came out and said, you know, put in place some narrative around mandatory hijab. Women instantly went to protest. The women rights movement in Iran, it goes back 150 years. It didn't start after the revolution. all of these pressure on people, I'm not saying there wasn't more conservative part of society. You should remember that part is more open. But I'm saying after revolution, women started feeling it really close to their heart. And it wasn't only women who were experiencing this. It was men as well in different ways. And I think it's response to what the Islamic Republic have done. They brought in all the tools of oppression that was existed in the religion and used it to control the society. Mm-hmm. So imagine a society that's telling the woman, you have to wear hijab. And it's not just that, there's so many other rules and regulations around the world. And then if they don't obey you, then you either make the man in the family to go and implement those rules. And even if they disobey, they're going to face the consequences. Mm. So you're making half of the population concerned about their every single movement, because there might be consequences for that as you freely walk around this, down the streets, and someone doesn't like your outfit and they arrest you, and then you might die. And then the men as well are paying the price. Mm. So the population is busy with something else other than asking for, you know, the better management of the oil money that the country has, mm-hmm. or like asking about the massive corruption that exists in the society, or, you know, going and protesting for their rights. And I think that formula has been used in Afghanistan in the same, way. And wherever you see authoritarian regimes are trying to control people, they're find a rule or a law that gives them this kind of massive access to control in different parts of the society.
I wanted to ask you about the current Supreme Leader, Ali Khamenei. He's made several public statements of a profoundly conspiratorial nature. He said that gender equality is a Zionist plot to corrupt the role of women in society. He denies the Holocaust. He's also warned against Iran, for example, accepting any aid from the US during COVID, because he suspected that they had engineered a special genetic version of the virus to harm Iranians. And he further explained that by saying that there are human and demonic enemies that were working together. So I'm just curious, from an insider, like, culturally, what role do you think conspiracy theories and supernatural cosmology play within the power structure and within, like, how as you're describing, this authoritarian strategy works in the society?
I've been tracking down corruption in Iran. So I have this podcast that focuses on corruption and how it grew. It's really amazing to see from the first day of inception of this idea and Islamic Republic, and they came to power, corruption was a massive part of it. Like, financial gain was really important for them. But whenever they're talking about financial gain, there is a conspiratorial link to it. There is this kind of like, oh, the God says this, and there's a rule that you have to follow. I think they've been amazing in adopting that into creating a culture of otherness, as well as creating a feeling for at least a part of the society. Not only you're going to lose the afterlife, you're going to lose whatever you have here, mm-hmm. any dignity you have in the society. And then within that, like the concepts of Beirat, which is kind of honor of a man, mm-hmm. or, you know, those kind of concept has been pushed up and brought into the picture, and was always like movies and cultural products that are creating this idea around it, that all of these people out there are after us. Mm-hmm. We are the only good people. And then if you don't follow us, you know, not only God wouldn't like you, then you would lose whatever you have. There were people inside that system who came out and spoke against it. And as soon as they came out and said, like, yeah, this is happening, but at the same time, how can you say that God said a woman should wear a hijab, but at the same time, steal all of that money, and then that guy vanishes. Mm-hmm. So they hushed every opposition, every voice that might have spoke out about these kind of things. The conspiracy and that spirituality feeling is growing because the government put a lot of money in it. They created this new field of medicine. They call it Islamic medicine, which basically like selling weird stuff, combining herbs and stuff without any research behind it. And the supreme leader has this idea, oh, this is going to take over the Western medicine and we're going to be really successful. So when COVID vaccine came in, they were like, you know, all of these talk about, oh, the Western vaccines are dangerous, so we're going to go for China. But behind it, it's none of this. It's about that guy who got a really good contract with China and wants to sell the Chinese vaccine. And they put this kind of conspiracy theory on top of it and said it to people.
Yeah, it's, you know, we had Naomi Klein on to talk about her idea of the mirror world and you know, how everything is sort of upside down right now. And this is a perfect example of that. You're talking about the actual conspiracy behind the conspiracy theory. Actually, there's all this corruption and we've got these contracts and we're profiting from this, but we're going to tell you something else that's conspiratorial and false. And then at the same time, it's very convenient to identify outside enemies that are threatening to take away everything good that we have so that you are distracted from actually recognizing that you don't have a lot of good stuff, that you're under incredible oppression and living with this corruption and this top-down power structure that is, it seems, incredibly selfish and manipulative.
And it's amazing, like when you have that for 4 decades, the first generation would say, and this is what happened to me, like my mom and dad would say, we just have a revolution. We don't want another one. We've lost a lot. A lot of people died. In my generation, yeah, there were some people who were active like me. You know, we've tried, but we never felt like we can go as far as we can go right now. Mm. Then the generation after us, like right now, those teenagers in the streets, they're the children of people, you know, my generation. Mm. And we have a different feeling about the whole system. And I think that's why you hear about, you know, women life freedom, because for us, that top to down system is not going to work. Mm-hmm. We're learning it as a lived experience, mm-hmm. that the system that can bring equality needs to be based on feminist values, based on women's rights and the rights of every single minority and marginalized group of the society. Women as the biggest marginalized group, mm-hmm. they're the link between these different groups. They're Baluchis, they're Kurds, they're Baha'i, they're Arab, coming from every corner of the society. Mm-hmm. Iran can be a really interesting place to watch in the coming years, mm-hmm. because from what I hear coming from the ground, Iranian women are not going to shy away from it. Mm-hmm. They're in a war, and they're going to continue until they win. One way or another. But how it looks like after that, I think in the next couple of years, we see it forms better, gets organized, and then we can have an understanding what would the outcome look like.
It's very powerful. It's very powerful. I mean, I hear you basically saying that the strategy of dividing and conquering through all of these different marginalized groups essentially fails because of the solidarity.
Yeah.
Shared between women who come from all of those different groups and are basically standing for the same values.
In our network, so in Azadi Network, a network that I built after Gina Masamini's death, we're mostly women, not by, you know, we didn't choose, but it was just like, okay, who can collaborate and work in an environment that is collaborative, mm-hmm. bringing other people? And it's not just about us being seen. It's about raising other people. Who's ready to take the responsibility of lifting other people from the ground? And you see a lot of amazing women from different groups coming together and helping each other. We have this fantastic Baluch activist that has been part of our community from the beginning. And now she actually won like prizes for her bravery and encouragement. But the reason she's standing there, she's coming from the most deprived part of the society. There's like lack of clean water or, you know, access to healthcare. It's totally been ignored by the society. And there's on top of the societal patriarchal system, it's a tribal part of Iran. She learned all of these skills and got verification or like validation for her thinkings because these women from different parts of the society came around her and talked to her, lifted her from. Someone taught her English. The other person taught her to do computer thing. Like everyone chipped in And I think that's the future I want to see. Mm-hmm. A future that in that gender doesn't matter and we're lifting each other up.
Well, I want to hear more about your work in a moment, but I have one last question for you before we go there a little more deeply. I want to turn our attention towards the US and how I observe, and I'm not alone in this, this kind of parallel rise of Christian nationalism. And I say parallel because I see, even though it's not as pervasive, I see some parallels with what has happened in Iran. You have Christian nationalism on the rise here and this new supermajority in the Supreme Court that our own right-wing fundamentalists have worked really hard on for decades to establish. And these reactionary fundamentalists immediately began dismantling the progress that has been made over the last 50 years in other areas too, but especially around women's rights. And you alluded to this earlier as well. So as someone with your background, how does this strike you?
It's really disappointing, seriously. But it's not surprising because when you look at how the progress happened in the US and development of ideas happened, unfortunately, a lot of us, for different reasons, haven't been successful at explaining our ideas to other people. And we lived in our bubbles. And then social media came on top of that and kind of made our bubbles smaller because we're talking to our own people and we are getting more extreme in our own point of views. Understanding and compassion is kind of lacking in our conversations. And that led to, again, people who are not feeling safe enough in their own space to find something to blame. Yes, a woman is threatening my identity as a masculine man. Yeah, I'm going to fight back. The reaction to Me Too, I think for me, like when I'm saying it wasn't a surprise, for me it was watching the reaction to Me Too campaign in the US and talking to people in the US, like talking about the failure of it. In my view, it was a success, but it was, I from outside for us, it meant, oh, finally someone is taking charge in this situation. But in reality, grassroots movement in the women's movement didn't exist in the US, especially in the central part of it. And I can see that happening in other parts of the world because what would that person do who doesn't have that much to lose in life and then spending a lot of time on social media, they're going to go and find people who validate them. In coming years, we're going to see more divides, more rise of, as you mentioned, any form or groups that are going against women's rights, first of all, and then anti-war narrative that is out there. Mm-hmm. I think because these two are the core masculine things that are out there. Like for a lot of these groups that are, extremists, these two are the core fundamental part of their ideology. Because if you take these two away from them, their identity is gone. Mm-hmm. A lot of these men, they don't have any replacement. That's why I'm following with all of these crazy YouTubers or, bodybuilders.
Yeah, so you mentioned an assault on women's rights and also a kind of crackdown on anyone who is sort of anti-military or anti-war. And then what we've seen here with this new Supreme Court as well is not only did they overturn Roe versus Wade, but they're looking at, various kinds of legislation that has to do with whether or not employers or healthcare plans or doctors are required to provide birth control, because that may be an issue of quote unquote religious freedom. And then you have the removal of the striking down of the affirmative action legislation that had been in place for a long time too. And then the other one that we haven't mentioned yet, which is a big threat supposedly to traditional masculinity, is gay rights, right? That's sort of next. How are we going to look at gay marriage is, I think, on the docket too for this current Supreme Court. Are the issues around, you mentioned tribalism. I don't know if immigration is as big of an issue there because it's a really big issue here too, right? So any of these things that can be framed in a sort of pseudo-populist way as threatening the common man, so to speak. Are some of these additional issues at play in Iran as well?
Yeah, definitely. Immigration, especially, we have a big population of Afghan immigrants in Iran. Mm. unfortunately, they're right. Government has been playing this different campaigns around it and propaganda campaign during after Women Life Freedom. This 6 months in, 8 months in, they started this massive campaign against the Afghan populations, saying they kill people. You know, there were a lot of disinformation going around on social media and stories of rape, murder. They were trying from other parts of the society to kind of counter that. But I think it's always plays in their hand, isn't it? Like that fear of unknown, and you mentioned that. No wonder that at every step, we have to be vigilant. We have to think about, if we are an activist, we have to think about how to make sure that the energy in our communities are not dying away. How to make sure they feel the urgency of this moment that we are living in the history and the urgency of action. They need to take action. It's not the time to sit down and do nothing. Mm. And I think it's that passion and action that is missing right now, especially. One other aspect of it that comes to mind a lot, especially when I'm talking with the Iranian community as well as the British here, is that we became really politically correct in our language. And that kind of discriminates some of the people who are suffering from being able to express their suffering and finding and carving their own path through it to get to us. So if we want to create like any other sustainable thing, changing behaviors and creating a change that is long lasting, you have to find that common language again and hopefully bring the other parts of society that disagree with us to a common ground.
Well, along those lines, I wanted to ask you about your work. I know that after leaving the BBC's World Service, you've devoted your time both to activism and to tech-based ventures, is the impression I have, that aim to empower women and girls. So what would you like us to tell us about any of those initiatives, as well as about the Azadi Network?
I was really lucky to get involved with some amazing people in San Francisco who, after BBC, gave me the opportunity to work with them in the technology sector and learn from them. I think that was really interesting. One of the things that we worked on and it's still going, it was this app for holistic approach to period pain. Because everyone is like, oh, menstruations, I don't want to fund that. If you're talking about pregnancy, then I'll give you the money. Even in that field, the lens is really patriarchal. Because they think, oh, you know, woman means woman when they can reproduce. Mm-hmm. And the fact that some women are going through different types of pains and, you know, on a daily basis are suffering and doesn't interest that many investors. But when Women Life Freedom happened, I kind of felt that my calling is what I'm doing every day now, which is called Azadi Network. I wake up with energy to build communities, to organize people and allow people to work together and share their resources. And there are a lot of skills I'm using there and I'm learning a lot.
Well, this has been very illuminating and enjoyable. Thank you, Nagin. How can our listeners find out more and participate in what you're doing in the world?
We have a website called azadi.network. And I love people like drop us a message and tell us what do you think about Women Life Freedom? Is there anything? We're hoping to be able to have a conference with feminists and thinkers from around the world on different fields to talk about a nation state that is led by women. How would it look like? What the economy would look like? How would you run the society and, you know, create a grassroots that is working, the civil society that can work with the government? So all of these questions that everyone is having regarding creating an equal society, we want to examine them and answer, maybe find an answer to them in a conference. So anyone who's interested in that, just raise your hand. We would love to have you and talk and see what we can do.